listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. The fearless writer Sapphire is, as you know, a renowned poet as well as a novelist, and her poet's sensibility permeates the pages of her fiction, including her fabulous new novel, The Kid. "Why does looking at the blue of the sky seem like it's murdering your heart?" asks Abdul Jones, the young man at the heart of this book. Abdul is the son of Clarice Precious Jones, whose story and struggle we absorbed in the novel Push. And that story, as you may remember, ended with Precious, twice impregnated by her father and now HIV positive, promising to protect and love her secondborn, the boy she named Abdul. Through Abdul's fierce voice, we learn what it means to be young and black and born with HIV in America. This generational story, which moves from a Mississippi dirt farm to Harlem in its heyday, tells of a 21st century young man's fight to find a way toward the future. Sapphire is the author of two collections of poetry and the best-selling novel Push. The film adaptation of her novel Precious received the Academy Award for Best Screenplay and Best Supporting Actress. In 2009, she was the recipient of a United States Artist Fellowship, and her work has been translated into 13 languages and has been adapted for the stage in the United States and Europe. And in conversation with Sapphire tonight, we have Bridget Mullins, who's a playwright and poet, whose work includes Monkey in the Middle, Fire Eater, and Pathological Venus. She was the director of creative writing at Harvard University and served for 15 years as the director of the reading series at DIA Arts Foundation in New York. She's also the recipient of many grants, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, and she's the director of the Master's in Professional Writing program at USC, although this fall finds her happily on sabbatical, and we're always so pleased when Bridget's spirit, insight, and generosity can be a part of Aloud. Please join me in welcoming Sapphire and Bridget Mullins to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Well, I'm really, this mic is working, yeah? Okay, so I'm really happy to be here tonight. And so I'm going to read a short section of the novel, and then we're going to talk, Bridget and I, and then we will talk, you and I. So in this section of the novel, Abdul is, his name has been changed, and he's calling himself JJ, and he's in a Catholic orphanage, St. Ilanthus, and it's here he first encounters what is to be his passion in life, dance. This happens on the day the staff at the school have taken the children to a swimming pool. But Abdul, JJ, as he's calling himself now, and his best friend decide to sneak off from the other children and go get high, which JJ has never done before. And at some point, they realize they need to rejoin the group in the swimming pool. So they decide to sneak into the gym, which is on the top floor, and then sneak down to the basement where the pool is and pretend they have been there all along. And this is not going to be hard because they are 13 and 14 years old, and they realize all adults are stupid. So all they're going to have to do is get up in the gym and splash some water on and then go down and say, "Hey, I was in the pool. What's the deal?" So we find him at that very moment, and he's telling us, hey, I'm way high for the first time, and this scary dude I'm with, no plan but complain. I ain't scared of them people at the orphanage. Hey, usually if ain't no guys playing basketball, the gym is empty. But when we get up the stairs, I stop short. All kind of people in here today dressed in bright colored tights, leotards, and sweats. Some got on African clothes. On one side of the room, like trees growing up from the floor, are four shiny drums sitting in front of four empty chairs. A big guy taller than me in a long white African robe sits down behind the biggest drum. Then three more dudes sit down behind the other drums. They go bap, bap, tee-dee-dee, bap, bap. Another guy picks up a flute and starts to blow. It's so beautiful, it hurts. Feels like somebody kicked me, then wild, man, wild. Maybe it's the marijuana, the black tie, maybe. but it's still real. Something stopped screaming in my head, and in 1 second, I know my life, it's this sound. What's up, man? Jaime is looking at me weird. I shake my head. Guy blowing on the flute is killing now like a tidal wave or atom splitting or some shit. This is from way before Hamlet. Bap, tee-dee-dee, bap, bap. The drums break and stop. A woman in a yellow leotard and African skirt steps in front of the people and says, "Everybody back so we can start moving across the floor." "Man, let's get out of here," Jaime says. "These people is dancers or some shit." No, I groan. I ain't going nowhere. "Get in lines of six," the teacher says. Everybody does what she says, including me. Jaime is staring at me like I'm stupid. I look at him and go meet what's mine, shit like I went to him when I wanted. I get in the back line behind a fat Spanish-looking girl in a brown and blue African skirt who is stepping side to side, bobbing her head to the beat. "Huh, why don't you take off your shoes," she says, bending from her waist till her torso is over her knees, still stepping side to side. I take off my shoes and start stepping side to side right behind her. The drums heat up and the woman in yellow hollers, "Adelejo!" The people start moving and I move with them. So this is like a pivotal point in his life in that since his mother has died, he has had a deep sense of alienation, loss, and separateness. And in this act of dancing, as he says, the people move and I move with them. And so for an instant, he has a sense of connection with other human beings. And as he, in his foster care placement and in the orphanage, he is abused. And one of the things that learning to dance does, dance defies the authority of the trauma to totally define him and to render him a mute victim. And in this section, we see how with dance, he talks back. And so he's by now, he's hot. He just think he's ruling the floor, but he's learned a few steps now. So he's talking to us again. He says, "I listen to the beat, da-da-da-da, 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't care what it's about. I just want to do it. I start to move across the floor. The drums seem like my own heart beating. A guy has a long string instrument. It's pure fire. The music rocks. My body turns into an ear hearing it. My body is not a stranger here. Not a traitor tricked by white priest in long robes. Not a little boy in a hospital bed. Not a big man with shiny eyes that makes people look at him. Here, my body is my own. Here I am a crazy horse dude who never gave up. Here I am like that dude Brother John told us the Schomburg got started by. Here I am music, and I never been to no police station. Here I got a mother, and she ain't no hoe die of AIDS. Here in the beat is my life. The flute shrieks, and I come again and again, and can't nobody stop me."
Sapphire, as I listened to you read that, I realized how much joy Abdul has and what potential he has. And he gets that from his mother.
Exactly.
So there's just this kind of sensory, somatic epitomization that's going on with Abdul. And I think that, you know, this book has received a lot of attention. And a lot of people have talked to you about the degree of trauma that Abdul has gone through. But I don't know if people have addressed the kind of humor and joy that's
exactly.
also in the book.
Exactly. Well, I think people are having a lot of trouble with the survival mechanism, the humor, and the joy, because the joy is directly related to his sexuality and his love of the physical, and his love of dance, and he's also a violent child at times. So if he was, as his mother was, learning the alphabet, I think people could relate to that. But here we see a deeply physical child, a sexual child, a child who is aware of his sexuality, at the threat of it. You know, he says it, in the dance, he's safe. He's not a victim for sexual predators, and he's also, in the dance, not a predator himself. He finds power through movement. But other times he does find power through affecting the behavior of the people who have abused him. So he is a problematic character. He's not a little angel like his mom. He is a deeply flawed character, but he's, in my opinion, he's more human than Precious.
Well, Precious has
Precious had a pedestal. We could not knock her off. That's why I had to kill her off. You know what I mean? she was too good to be true. I'm only kidding there. But Abdul is Abdul is a real child, and he is one. Well, I mean, he's a fictional character, but he's a child who has gone through. Imagine if you were the caretaker or the teacher of some of these children who have survived Jerry Sandusky at Penn State. So he's that child, and so he's not perfect. He's not always lovable. But if you have compassion and empathy and some understanding of what he's been through, he is a lovable character.
And also the shame that Precious has about her body. He breaks that cycle of shame.
Yes,
as well.
He does. Well, we see it in the end of the very last lines of Push. We see kind of the limitations. Precious just hasn't had that much time to live or to grow. She's going to die at the age of 27. But she says, in this child, I see my own beauty. So she never really does. And the society does not allow her to see herself as beautiful. She becomes acceptable to some people. But, she's a dark-skinned, obese black woman who never really gets a chance to see herself as beautiful. She's never gotten to Africa. She's never, had people to really affirm her. She's never had any alternative view of herself. But she has enough sense to look at her child and know, my child is beautiful. And in him, I see my own beauty, because he looks like her. But Abdul has no problem. He knows he's fine. He knows that other people perceive him as fine. He's educated at the age of 9 years old when she dies. He reads better than she did at 18. We're teaching her to read at the age of 16. So he's a gifted child, and everything is going all right, like it does for many, many children of single mothers. But when this mother dies, there's no safety net. There's no extended family. He can't go to grandma. He can't go to Monique. there's no husband or ex-husband. Precious is alone in the world, and the friendships that she's made are not people who are strong enough to take on Abdul.
They themselves don't have any support system.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. There's a part where Precious is dying, and the doctor tries to hand Abdul to Rita Romero, who is Precious's best friend, so that Abdul can stand by her bedside. And Rita literally cannot hold him. Mm-hmm. She's so weak, she herself is going to die soon. So,
and that opening, that whole opening, which is such a tour de force of consciousness, you find out later that Abdul, and he mentions in the section that you read, that he's read Hamlet, and it's really inflected him.
Right.
And he's read Langston Hughes, and
exactly.
He's read deeply, and he's got this vocabulary and all these different levels that he can go to.
Exactly.
But that can't save him. And that's part of
part of why, knowledge, I mean, this is the nature of being human. So the humans are one of the mammals that have an extended childhood. Being brilliant, being educated, being well-read, he's still a child. He still needs a support system. And when that falls, he falls also.
So when I was rereading it this time, I was thinking about, there's something Flannery O'Connor says, something like, when people are blind, you have to write in Braille, or you have to write really large. And
exactly.
I feel like there's a largeness about the book, because the level of trauma is so huge that it's actually traumatic reading it.
Exactly.
You have it's mm-hmm. a traumatic mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. And it's such an indictment of so many different levels
right.
of societal failure.
But I want
failure.
People to... In order, because this character is going to go on to be arrogant, he's going to go on to do some pretty horrendous things, in order for us to understand and empathize with him, we have to connect with the trauma that has created him, or else he just becomes a monster. So we have to look into what has happened to him and how him as an individual, but how children like him end up doing these things. I mean, it's part of the reason that, you know, the Supreme Court just said we can't have youthful offenders in jail for life because they're not fully adult. They're children. So we have to look at who he is as a child and what has happened to him. And we also have that first section of the book to really show his youthful innocence when he's still his mommy's baby. And he's still not, it takes him that whole first section to deal with his mother being dead. He goes into denial and starts to talk with her in his head. He will not let her go.
She's such a presence in his life.
She's
in
everything.
The opening. Yeah.
Yeah,
and as she is for any reader who read Push. I mean, you read that novel and you feel like you have this, and then the same thing happens with the kid, but in a much more complicated way.
Right.
It's such an intense sort of depth charge into this consciousness where sometimes you don't know if he's dreaming. He doesn't know if he's lying. He doesn't know if it's the truth. It's a really, if you haven't read the book yet, it's such a plunge into, it's this linguistic torque. It's the closest thing to consciousness, I think, besides poetry that's like just taken out of the moment. But you go through, you're in his mind. And I guess one question I had for you, because you know, I know a lot of people have looked at your work and have wondered how much is autobiographical. And now I think we all know it's not autobiographical.
Exactly.
There's a kind of...
It's created.
It's great. These are created characters. Mm-hmm. These are not real people that you experienced. You grew up in Los Angeles. Very, very different background than either of these characters. Mm-hmm. But especially this wild boy.
Yeah.
How did you get into that
part character? Part of, you know, creating this, you know, the layers of his consciousness were really who he was. He was a character who, you know, if we were in a literature class, we would call him an unreliable narrator. We can't believe a thing this boy says. He lies. With his mother, we could have a straightforward narrative because every word she said was true. Her heart was on her sleeve. There was never any doubt, you know what I mean? With him, we have to go into his nightmares. We have to go into his dreams. We have to go into his fevered imaginings to begin to deal with who he is, what he has done, where he is going. He is not a simple, straightforward character. So if you had done a linear narrative, you know what I mean, without this kind of levels of stream of consciousness, I think I would have had to revert to a third person narrative and, you know, stood on top of the story and told it. And I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I think it distances the reader, and I wanted people to be in his head.
Mm-hmm. And how, I know I've heard you talk about how you could sometimes compartmentalize the writing process so that, like a dancer or an actor, you would relive it or live it for a few hours a day and then shut it down. But how could you really, in your dreams, you're reading the book, he's with you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it take to write the book? What was that process like of living with him over a number of years?
It was... On some level, it was actually depressing because he was like a monkey on my back, and it was like I was having a hard time artistically, but I was also having a hard time emotionally, you know, finishing the novel and stuff like that. So he was really weighing on me, and I think I was anticipating kind of the negative criticism, and part of me was wanting to write a novel that people wanted, you know what I mean, a rags to riches, you know, feel good type of story, but knowing that this was a story I was going to have to write and that people would have, you know, not always positive reactions to it. And then the other part was just like being on a roller coaster or a skateboard, you know what I mean? It's scary to be on it, but it's scarier to jump off. So sometimes when I would get into that writing of his, you know what I mean? I would have it maybe timed. I'm going to write for an hour. So I couldn't stop because to to stop would scare me. You know, it would scare me to be in it, but it would scare me to stop because when I stopped, I'd have to reread what I had written, and I was being frightened as I was writing.
This is interesting, talking about the book that you thought people, because people did want more.
Yeah,
they wanted more.
They wanted push number two.
But the thing is, people talked about it as if it were a sequel, and it's not really. And the book that people wanted, I think, you gapped. It's the book of that we get the backstory in Abdul's mind of his life with Precious.
Exactly.
It's delicious.
It's not a sequel. Precious dies in the first chapter. But as Abdul deals with his memories and dreams, we find out how, you know, just out of nowhere, he'll be depressed and, you know, kicking the leaves, and then he'll remember a bus trip upstate with Precious when he was a little boy and his mother takes him upstate to see the leaves turn. Or he'll remember being taken to the Schomburg, or he'll, in the dancing, you know, he'll remember her kissing him and stuff like that. So we get an idea of what her life was like. And also I think there's a section where he, you know, little kids, he walks in on the bathroom and she has her HIV medications lined up, and he counts the jars, something like 13 jars, and she keeps telling me there's nothing wrong. How come she has so many medicines? You know, so we get it.
We get his relationship and what happens
to her life in a certain kind of way. And the triumph, you know, that she raises this little boy, that she gives him an education, and also the tragedy.
And he says at one point, "I'm a lover, not a fighter."
Yeah.
And you keep seeing him want to love. He wants the love.
Exactly.
It's like this series of misfortunes.
Yeah, it's almost like a ball against a brick wall. Everything he does gets thrown back in his face.
Which brings up another question for me. Right after that second section that you read about dance, I think that's when he gets sick in the class and the dance instructor and her boyfriend take him home, and at some point they're trying to get his story out of him. And the boyfriend keeps saying, "You're not going to get the whole story. You're not going to get the..." And part of it is Abdul doesn't know his own story.
But he's making it up as he goes along. You know, they ask him, "Where are you going?" And he hasn't refined his story yet. So the dance instructor's boyfriend says something like, where are your parents? And so he says, "Well, you know, my mother died in a car accident, and my father died in the war." And the boyfriend is astute enough to know to ask, "Well, what war?" And Abdul is speechless. He doesn't know what war. He's just made up a war. So as he goes along, he starts to get his lies straight. But we actually watch him start to prevaricate and rearrange reality. A reality that he can live with. He cannot live with that my mother died of AIDS. The stigma is too great for him. That's part of the reason why we have such a hidden population now. Part of the reason some people talk about it, some people don't. So he cannot deal with that. He cannot deal with. He does not really know about his father, but he intuits it's something horrible. So he makes up a father who died in the war. He makes up a mother who died in a car accident. He makes up a grandmother who died of cancer. He makes up what he thinks is a normal family, because his ego cannot deal with the truth yet, you know, as most children can't.
And there's so many layers of backstory in when you meet his great-grandmother, slavery days, he calls her, which is so hilarious and so horrifying, the whole thing. But just to go back to this question about audience, is very interesting to me, and like anticipating an audience. And I wondered if you would read, because you said if I found a section, you would read it. On 119.
I think the pagination is a little different on the paperback, so just give me where you
want to read. 1 second. I think like this.
Okay.
I often mark up my books, so.
Okay, this is he's coming home with the dance. He's gotten sick in his African dance class, and the teacher is taking him home, and the teacher's boyfriend is named Ibrahim. Uh, So Ibrahim, the boyfriend, this is Abdul, boyfriend got to put his 2 cents in. How long you been coming to class now? A few months, I say. What's that got to do with anything? Well, you want to keep coming to class, you got to talk to Emina here. Don't tell him that, Ibrahim. He doesn't have to tell me anything, and he can keep coming to class. Have you been messing around with drugs, JJ? She looks at Ibrahim. Where are you going? It's only around the corner at the boys' home. He said St. Nicholas Avenue. You moved, JJ? You not at St. Ilanthus Orphanage anymore? I feel seasick, even though I'm not in a boat and I'm too tired to cry. I just want to be left alone. JJ, did those freaks beat you up? Answer me. Emina is really upset. Look, man, we just want to help you. Emina is not going to call the pigs or nothing. Well, look at you, man. You got blood on your T-shirt, stitches on the top of your head. Your face is all slaps open. You was dancing all erratic and shit, man, and then you fell out. Look, we brothers and sisters, man. You want to be an African dancer? Then you want to be part of a community. Artists stick together. JJ, if you can't tell us, who can you tell? Nobody.
That's, I mean, to me, I read that, and I was like, if you can't tell us, who can you tell? And you're talking directly to your readers here in a way, because if we can't hear this story, and what interests me about that passage, and I think from, you know, I'm someone who teaches young writers, as you do, mm-hmm. there's so much of this novel is interior monologue.
Exactly.
And so you only are getting his unreliable narrator interior monologue until mm-hmm. we meet people like this phenomenal teacher or the nurse who takes care mm-hmm. of him, Blondie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, these people who... The language is also...
Exactly.
But that thing is the artists. We're artists.
Exactly.
If you can't talk to us, who can you talk to?
And then when he says that, you know, so at some point you do have to give your reader some clue. When he says, nobody, we know that he's a liar and he's going to not tell the truth to anybody. And one of the ways we're going to get the truth is by other people looking at him, the teacher looking at him and... you know, mm-hmm. up until that moment, when we listened to Abdul talk about the dance class, he said, I was dancing my ass off. But the boyfriend says, man, you got blood on you. You're erratic. Mm-hmm. The teacher thinks his dancing looks like he's on drugs. So we begin to get alternative views, alternative takes on the reality.
It's a very complicated reading experience. Mm-hmm. We just did Kafka's Metamorphosis in one of my classes, and I was actually reminded of Gregor Samsa, mm-hmm. of this person who just wakes up one day mm-hmm. and is cast off and
right.
is reviled mm-hmm. and is looked at a certain way. Mm-hmm. And there's this metamorphosis that's taken mm-hmm. place.
That's actually one of my favorite novels, The Metamorphosis. It actually affected me more, The Metamorphosis, actually in writing Push, because here we have a profile of a family destroyed, and whatever you know, the reason Kafka had no reason to present this kind of politically correct view of the Jewish family. He could really show the father is almost a human carnivore, and the sister who Kafka, who Gregor loves so much, paying for her violin lessons, she betrays him. Everybody ultimately betrays him, and there is no happy ending. You know, there is no happy ending. It is not everybody, where's the redemption? You know, there is no redemption.
Yeah.
He dies. You know, he dies, you know what I mean? And I think that there's a way that, you know, we've begun to make expectations on literature that, you know, okay, you can take us up and down, but at the end, you have to fix it. You know?
It's a miracle that, mm-hmm. well, I guess this is why you chose Lee Daniels to direct mm-hmm. the film, that... that Precious didn't like go to Weight Watchers and
exactly. when I was in the process of trying to find a publisher for Push, one of the editors that we went to said, "Oh man, this is out of sight. But all we need is for her to is you know at the end she needs to lose weight and find a boyfriend." So it's like the romantic. The romantic demands of the culture, the desire for a total escapism, is almost, you know, something that a real writer has to run from. You know, I mean, that you have to fulfill the expectations of your reading public as opposed to create expectations. So I want to create expectations for the reader. I want them to you know, have the courage, because it's only a book. People are living this. We're just reading it. But I want them to think, if it was like a deep sea diver, that this time we're going to go 100 feet down, you know, and then next time 150 feet. Like, so instead of making you feel good, I'm going to make you stronger so that you can bear, as T.S. Eliot said, man cannot bear too much reality, but part of becoming a conscious and literate audience is beginning to bear more and more reality.
So do you see yourself as a realist?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I really do. I think a little bit. I was really, you know, I'm still grappling with all of her work. I love it. But how they describe Flannery O'Connor as a grotesque realist. So, and I think that's unfair. But what they mean when they talk about the grotesque part of realism is that she has taken realism and taken certain aspects of the realistic experience and blown them up to where they're, you know, like how when you photograph skin and you get real close to it and you see all the pores, mm-hmm. and so that's what they're calling grotesque. So there are some grotesque elements in both texts, but I always adhere to there's nothing ever that could not have happened.
It's hard to tell sometimes whether something's happening when he's reporting it.
Yeah, but whether they've happened or not, they're credible. There are things that could have happened. Mm-hmm. So when he makes mm-hmm. up the lie, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no time where, like, in other words, when we talk about magical realism in something like Toni Morrison's novels, where, you know, they're in the end of Song of Solomon, he flies. So you never have that, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. things that could not happen. So in order for him to fly, I have him dreaming, and mm-hmm. in the dreams he can fly, mm-hmm. which we all can fly in the dreams, you know, mm-hmm. in our dreams. But I don't ever depart from what I think is reality, you know. So in dance class, he jumps 4 feet, which is what a strong male dancer can do. He doesn't jump 40 feet, you know, because that isn't something people can do.
Mm-hmm. And then when you were writing the novel, did you have an idea of where it was going, or did he reveal himself to you through research? Did you research?
A lot of the, you know, I when I was younger, I studied dance formally, so a lot of the dance parts I knew. A lot of the parts about his sexuality and, you know, the problems that he was going to have, I researched. So I think like 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of texts. Now, you know, there are a lot of texts about, you know, there's one, I had one text just on young males who abuse, you know. So there are the texts social workers read and stuff like that I had access to. I had friends who worked in social services, and I would ask them, I would ask therapists and stuff. So I think, you know, there's a psychological realism to this kind of cycle of abuse. There were fun parts to research in terms of like when I was with Dia, and we worked at the Earth room, and you know, I was working with a Earth science teacher, and we did dialogue journals and with Earth science. So that comes in there, mm-hmm. and just really looking at the actual. Underpinning of New York City, you know, the mm-hmm. rocks and stuff, mm-hmm. earth science and stuff. So that type of thing was fun.
And you are such an urban writer.
The city. I really like. There's no part where he's walking or on a street corner or something that I didn't do that walk 10 times.
Okay,
you know, and just try to position myself to see, okay, on this side he's standing here, and we can see the such and such projects and stuff like that, and, you know, he's walking south on St. Nicholas, and the granite is exposed and stuff like that, and there's some parts actually that have changed. There's, like, he describes going into a decaying park, and actually that's been renovated and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but I think it's a realistic text in that way.
So there's that foundation of verisimilitude, and then there's
exactly.
the
psychological. And when he goes up to, you know, the bell tower, in Marcus Garvey Park, yeah, he talks about, you know, at one point, you know, when they had, you know, horse driven fire wagons and stuff, and they would go up and ring the bell when New York had thatch roofs. And so he has a sense of, of history too. You know.
So do you feel with Push, definitely an experimental novel in a lot of ways, and the kid is experimental. It's not going along or with normal narrative expectations. So do you can you talk about that a little bit? How do you? It's a different form from Push. The kid is way out there.
Right. The kid is way out there, and in some ways, structurally, it is more. It is way out there in terms of the stream of consciousness and stuff. But some of the ways it's structured is more conventional than Push, because with Push, a good part of the novel is told through this dialogue journal and in dialect. And in the invented spelling of the classroom and stuff like that. And none of that, you know, I realized this novel was going to be problematic already. So if I start throwing in a whole bunch of dialect and things that are going to throw the reader further off course, that's going to be hard. So we actually have Abdul adhering to a standardized urban English. In fact, he's disdainful of certain dialect, you know.
Which is so funny.
Yeah,
he'll repeat. Somebody will say something grammatically incorrect, and he'll repeat it.
Yeah, you know.
But I guess what I meant by out there, it's longer, it's deeper.
Oh, no, I think this is much more intense.
Yeah.
It's much more intense.
Someone said to me after they read it, it makes Push look like Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah. Push is a little sweetheart of a novel. Like, when people come to you know, I call them, you know, my Push people, when they come to buy the kid and they say, oh, I'm going to buy this for my daughter, I ask them, well, how old is your daughter? Oh, she's 14. I say, well, you know, don't. Wait till she's 18 or something. This is not a, you know, kid. I mean, Push wasn't a children's book, but this really is not for children. This is really the places this is going to go. I don't think this is not kids' literature. Yeah.
I think the first section is.
Yeah,
and then
But you can't. You're gonna. Most kids are gonna read the second section.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the third section, and that's gonna be. That's going to be a problem. So it really is, in other words, how do we find the language and how we create a text? So I'm writing about the survivors of people like Jerry Sandusky and of AIDS orphanages and stuff like that. So I'm writing about them for us because we're the ones who can do something. I'm not writing about it for them. So in other words...
Okay.
I'm not writing it about it for a nine-year-old, even though the text begins with the voice of a nine-year-old and then a 13-year-old. So it's for us. It is for it's adult writing about a child's life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that is the real line. It's not a literary line or anything that divides young adult literature from adult literature. It's who is your audience, and so the audience for this is an adult. And even though the text is about a child.
When the book is written in four sections, right? And each of the sections you have a different
epigraph. Yeah.
Which I love. The first one is Flannery O'Connor from Wise Blood. The second one is it I?
It's I, the poet I.
The poet I.
The first one I'm going to read them because I love them too. So this is from Wise Blood. And this is the title of the section is called Book One is called I'm Nine, and that he's Abdul is nine when Precious dies, and this is from Wise Blood, and this epitomizes the condition Abdul is now in. Where you come from is gone, your mommy is gone. Where you thought you were going to never was there. This middle class existence that she promised him no longer exists. You're an orphan. And where you are is no good unless you can get away from it. So the foster care placement that he's going to be put in is hell. You've got to go. So that's Flannery. Where you come from is gone. Where you thought you were going to was never there. And where you are is no good unless you can get away from it. And then book two is called Falling. And it's, he falls. I think there's a writer called Ernest Gaines who wrote... autobiography of Jane Pittman and A Lesson Before Dying. But he also wrote a novel called In My Father's House. And one of the characters in Ernest Gaines' novel, I never will forget this, is literally, Ernest Gaines can get away with anything. So he's looking across the floor, and I forget the protagonist's name, and it's the revelation of an affair or something horrible. And it's like in an auditorium, and the man just falls. You know, he just falls, you know, like as though he's having a stroke or something like that. So in this section, Abdul will fall, and it begins with the epigraph for falling is, he's grown up now, I'm 14. I'm a wind from nowhere. I can break your heart. And
he is a heartbreaker.
Yes, he does. Yeah, if you let him in, you know, you're going to have a problem.
And
so part two is falling, and part three is I don't hate my readers. Part three is called ascension, and in this we get to see him realize at least some of his dreams. You know, his dance, and it's from the we have a quote here from Sade, the rocker, right, the British rocker, and it's called, and it's just a section from one of her songs. Making me dance inside, your love is king. And it's in this section that through his art, he becomes a king, a master. In falling, he became a king through perpetration and violence. Mm-hmm. But here, he masters his body as an artist. And, you know, your love is king. So, and in the last section called Dirty for Dirty, we have a quote from Dostoevsky from Crime and Punishment. And he recalled it far more vividly in his dream than he had done in memory. So here we get to go through, he's had a breakdown, and we go through some rantings and some ravings with him. But in them, we start to pull out a thread of truth.
It's astonishing. The ending is astonishing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of you have read this, but you just take some time and you just sit with this book and you feel like no one can ever judge anyone. It's like let's get with this here. Mm-hmm. Let's like really look at each other and listen to each other. And I forget who said it, but some poet said about another poet, what he sees is tragic, that he sees is a consolation. Mm-hmm. And that is the feeling I get from the book. And the parts that are left out, the parts that are gapped, mm-hmm. I think there's so much mastery mm-hmm. in that, because that would have been the cake for you to write. It would have been cake for you to write Precious.
Exactly.
And Abdul. Exactly. I mean, we get that.
Or the happy ending, or to fill in, or to give the answers where we're really trying to raise the question here.
Because really there aren't answers. There's the only
exactly.
answer is to keep asking
exactly.
the question.
And also to, as you say, to that he sees. So it's interesting, the doctor who he finds himself in contact with is called Dr. C.
And Kafka.
I'm stealing there. It's called Dr. C. And his job in the text is to make Abdul look at what he has done. So Abdul has been a victim and has been caught in a cycle of abuse. But Dr. C brings Abdul back to the reality that the only part of the cycle of abuse that you have any control over is really what you do. And you cannot keep using your past as an excuse to oppress others. Mm. And he makes him look at the evil that he has done. And he's still too young to really begin to take total responsibility for his life. But in this act of, and then we come all the way back to the beginning with Flannery O'Connor, a Catholic novelist, and the whole, for me, the whole idea of confession. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a broken, confused, and twisted confession, we don't even know whether his confession is the truth, but at some point he begins to unburden himself mm-hmm. of guilt and talk, and with that there is some hope that he can retrieve his senses.
And in terms of a character, I mean, what a character, what a magnificent character in American literature, in any literature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I can see where Dostoevsky comes in. Now, Dostoevsky and Flannery O'Connor, two of your writers.
Right, exactly.
And they both wrote out of that desire for faith. I mean, mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor, devout Catholic, and Dostoevsky wanted that faith. Mm-hmm. Do you write out of a spiritual system?
I think I write out of, Flannery O'Connor never lost faith. And like my characters in some way, this is about faith, but it is also about the broken faith and the loss of faith. Mm-hmm. So that's important that Abdul has no spiritual foundation, that the sense of a God has been taken from him, that the sense of a true God or, you know, a true beneficent being has been replaced with these oppressive males who lord over him. Mm-hmm. So all of that is important. So more than a display or connection of faith, I'm really looking at what has happened with the breaking of faith. And even the doctor and who helps him is a dubious character. We don't know whether he's just really helping him or just that he's a brilliant guy and is playing with him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mm-hmm. the end effect is, helpful for Abdul. But is this really a good person? We never know.
What's so interesting is that you trust your reader. You trust your reader to go there with you. And I think that's something that we don't, I mean, I there are so many amazing contemporary novelists, but this is really a level of trust in the reader that mm-hmm. we will go there with you.
Exactly.
And I think that's it's a form of faith. It feels mm-hmm. like a form of faith. And he has a kind of faith in aesthetics mm-hmm. and in dance. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about your process. In a few minutes, we're going to open this up to all of you. So if you have a question brewing, keep it brewing for a second. I'd love to hear, I know a little bit about your process, but I feel like it's so, there's a level of dedication and commitment that you have to your work that's, you know, this doesn't happen by accident. This is like,
right, yeah.
You know, this is something going on here. So mm-hmm. can you talk about that for a minute? Because I feel like we have some students in the audience from the program at USC.
To actually describe my process, because it took so long to write the book, my process actually changed as I was writing the book. But one of the things I remember, like with each book, is this feeling of, and it may, this may answer some of the negative criticism about the book, you know, overkill or the larger than life. But with each book, I felt like I could die now. I've said everything I have to say. Mm-hmm. And so there was this feeling of after American Dreams, I got everything out. I wrote this book, same after Push. And then after this book, I just really felt like, you know, I was not going to give up until I had really said what I had to say and really dealt with it, you know, with that sense of, well, suppose you never write another book. You know, because I was thinking about the last section, well, maybe I can write a sequel and start with that section, you know what I mean? And, you know, because I was getting afraid of it, you know what I mean? And then I said, no, you know, go there, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was that faith in myself that I could write this very difficult text and that I could stand up to what I had written. That I could stand up and fight back, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, not do it. That I could write it and then be prepared to defend it. Because the publishers can't do it. The reviewers are sometimes, you know, they get a book a week in advance and someone will tell them to write a review. They can't really always analyze it, you know. And the scholars, it takes them 15 years after Push, the scholars are able to write it. So, you know, because that's how long it takes. You know, they're still writing. They're half the scholarly women's community is writing about, still writing about Virginia Woolf. So, so you as the author, you as the painter, or you as the avant-garde dancer, or you as the architect who wants to make the building mostly glass or something, you have to be prepared to defend your creation mm-hmm. or just go ahead and do what's been done before. And
it took people years to catch up with Push. I mean, there was an immediate sort of,
it was underground.
Look at this.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, but, it was a, uh, uh, inner circle, kind of downtown-y type thing. But the mainstream didn't really pick up on it for a long time.
And, you know, there's that saying, everybody has their price. It seemed everybody but Sapphire had their price, because I remember you would say to me, so-and-so wants to make Push into a movie. And I'd be like, great. And you'd say, uh-uh. Years and years and years. And it's this feeling of a relationship that you have with your work and with your characters. And I think that is, that's a gift to us, you know, as readers. And I think also we'll see it in your influence in young writers as they read these books, because this isn't available. The film is brilliant, but it's not available in other forms. It's a reading. It's a language.
Yeah,
it's a language experience.
I thought the movie isn't my movie. It's Lee Daniels' movie, and I thought it was brilliant. I really love what he did, and but you know, the text is the text.
Yeah.
And the difference between a text and a movie is that you have one text, and from it, many people can make many different films. You know how they've done. I just was on a plane a couple months ago, and they had done a new film version of Great Expectations. You know how many versions of Great Expectations by Dickens they've done by a film. But there's only one Great Expectation. You know, I might make a film of Great Expectations. You know? But, you know, and so that'll be Sapphire's, but there's only one text. So there, you know, many people before the movie had done one-woman plays, there had been stage adaptions, and they all generate from one text. So, I mean, that's, to me, the power of the word, you know what I mean? And then, it's like, you know, just like when we were even dealing with the Bible, there's the word, and then there's the fundamentalist interpretation. There's the liberal interpretation, you know, there's the feminist interpretation of the word, you know what I mean? So, but ultimately there's the word.
I think that's a really good place to...
Thank you.
Actually, no, I'm just turning it over to the audience.
Okay. So... raise your hand and the microphone will fly to you in the form of this beautiful blonde.
Hi, thank you. Hello.
Hello.
It's an honor to be here. My question is, you spoke about the impact that writing this book had on you and the characters and the lives, and knowing that all of these characters may not be real, but they have real lived they're representations of lived experiences in the world.
That's perfect.
How do you get through? Like, how do you continue writing? What are the days like when you don't want to write, when you're just like, okay, you know, this, where do you go from there?
I think part of it is a habit. So by now, it's a habit. I remember when I was studying dance, and, you know, it would hurt to do a plié or a tendu and stuff, but it just becomes a habit. You know, this is what you have to do to warm up your body to dance. So for me, in the beginning, there was this, you know, act of discipline to get myself to write, and then there's always the act of reimmersion, like when I come back from a tour and stuff like that, it's especially hard. But for a little while, I know when I crossed the line, the discipline was no longer to write. The discipline is now to write better. But the discipline is also to engage in life. You know what I mean? Like, I would rather be writing than talking to, you know, my Aunt Susan. You know what I mean? I would rather be writing than, you know, doing a lot of other things. So, you know, so there's now the discipline of staying connected to life and being a whole person. So I think it's you know, there's writing is a fascinating way to spend your life. Yeah. It's coming. Look at this.
Could you go through your writing process as much as you care to share with us?
You know, It really varies, because I'm a multi-genre writer. So I might write a poem on the subway, you know, the subway in New York. I might, you know, get on at 125th Street and be finished with a poem by the time I get down to the Village, and then spend the next few months revising it. But there's a extended, at least for me, an extended need for time that the novel the novel requires. And for that, I would have to keep trying to structure my life to make time. So, you know, I would go to writer's colonies where I could sequester myself away from the phone and the demands of teaching. I now have a little studio where I can write, and Verizon was coming in to hook up the phone, and they messed it up, and I realized the phone jack is dead, and I said, that might be a good thing, you know what I mean? So there's that way of constantly, you have to, you know, nobody really cares, you know, there's enough books on the shelves, and for, you know, no, if I didn't care enough about my writing to create situations for the writing to happen, no one else is. So that's a large part of it. The process is constantly trying to find a way that I can continue to create work. And so that might mean, you know, being very staid and writing in the same place at the same time every day. Or it might mean packing my stuff up in a backpack and going up to the mountains to some retreat to sit in a little cabin. It's not like a set thing, you know what I mean? Thank you. Oh, you're very welcome.
Yeah, it seemed like you have such distinct voices and the characters have such distinct voices, and there's a real oral quality to poetry as well. So I was wondering if you could talk about maybe the impact of like hearing your work aloud, or like if you read your own work aloud, to like kind of capture that voice and kind of how like actually hearing something spoken aloud changes the words that like mm-hmm. are in the text. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
I actually, you know, I've heard that a lot. I think I read that Isabel Allende reads all of her work aloud to like her mom, I think, you know, before she published it. I actually don't read my work aloud as I'm writing it, but because I'm a poet and I'm used to hearing voices and hearing cadences and rhythm, I may as well be reading it aloud because I'm hearing it. I think I'm hearing it in my head, so I don't have to read it aloud. You know what I mean? Because I am hearing the sounds and you know the how the syllables and how the sentence is going to riff already. You know what I mean? So I'm not really reading it aloud in that way. So, but it is I am first a student of poetry, which is, you know, the word, you know, which is a form. One of my first teachers was at Brooklyn College was Allen Ginsberg. And one of the things he talked about with poetry, that poetry, he gave us two examples. I remember on the first day, and one was of the European town crier, the person who would go from town to town crying out the news, like the cliche is Paul Revere. But how he would remember the news, was by, the mnemonic device of N rhyme. And he would, the person would have these rhymes. And then he also talked about the African griots who had memorized the whole history of their villages, and they would use certain mnemonic devices and so that they could orally recite back to the village their knowledge of themselves, their history, because their history wasn't written down. It would be remembered by this griot. So that there was a kind of a oral training and a sense of I'm entering into a graduate program, and this is what he's talking about. And it gave me a sense that the oral culture is important, whether it's recognized or not, and that it's something to not just be taken for granted, but something to be studied and taken seriously.
And one thing around that was you mentioned Virginia Woolf, and mm-hmm. she, that stream of consciousness that Abdul sometimes goes into, she describes that as thought plunging into a sea of words and coming up dripping. Mm. And you can see Abdul doing that when he's sort of making up sounds. He's trying to match what's going on in the world with language. And that's one of the intense pleasures, I think, of reading your work, is seeing that happen. I'm sorry, another question.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Just want to ask, when you begin to write a novel, do you write from an outline, or how do you develop your characters?
No, I don't. I mean, I do outline, but I outline when I'm writing and I'm into it for a couple of months or a year and I get stuck, then I'll resort to outlining and things like that. But I don't start with an outline. I, you know, many people do, but I don't. That's a technique I'll use when I get lost. Yeah.
I consider you an activist writer, and you don't see too much activist writing since the 60s. And do you consider yourself as an activist writer? Because you tackle topics with Precious and the Kid that not too many people want to touch. And like you said, you have to defend your work. And I've known in circles that I've been in, Precious or Push was something that the mainstream didn't want to hear, and as well as the kids. So do you consider yourself an activist writer? And if yes, what is the role of activist writing?
Well, what I think that the role of the activist writer is pretty large, and I don't know if I can actually fill those shoes. I do know that the people who, some of my primary influences, consider themselves activists. In other words, Alice Walker considers herself an activist. Richard Wright considered himself an activist, and this is these are two writers who are very important to me. And do I measure up to them in my mind? No, I don't think so. So, but do I try? Yeah.
Thanks, Sapphire.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.